But it's recording. Okay. All right, just for the recording, this is the February 14th, 2022 virtual meeting of the Clallam County PUD Board of Commissioners. All right, our first item is a approval of the consent agenda. We have five items.
I have a comment.
Okay, go ahead, Jim.
I got a call several weeks ago from a customer kind of complaining about being late on a bill and getting, you know, the letter, we're going to terminate your power if you don't pay immediately. And she was a long-time customer that always paid her bills. Anyway, looking at the comments on the delinquent payments where we, you know, did cutoffs that are so forth, I noticed a little bit of inconsistency between the different people, and it also seemed like it sounded like they were getting a one letter, you know, one bill that said we're going to terminate, or one letter, and then it might have proceeded to that. I don't know if that's really the case or just the wording, but I'm not looking for an answer right now, but maybe Sean or if you guys, somebody could look into that a little closer and get back to me either in person or at the next meeting. That's all.
I can answer it right now if you'd like me to.
Okay.
So we have to comply with all applicable laws in the state of Washington. So the first notice that a customer receives is actually on their bill. And right. if we don't receive payment, then they get a final notice that's mailed to them in a special envelope that contains all the legalese verbiage on it. And if they don't pay that, then they get a second notice and then disconnected. So all customers are treated the exact same through that process.
Yeah, okay. That sounds good, but some of the wording in those paragraphs seems a little cryptic. Maybe we could do a better job there.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Other comments or questions on the consent agenda? Okay, do we have a motion?
Yeah, I move that we approve the consent agenda.
Second.
Moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for February the 14th, 2022. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Agenda revisions. Sean, do we have any?
None today.
Any from the board?
None for me.
Okay, good.
I'm fine.
All right, so we'll move on to comments from the public. T, are you're going to let people in as the request?
Yes, I will, Will. Does anyone from the public have any comments they would like to make at this point? If you do, please state your name or raise your hand. I'm not seeing anything, Will.
Yeah, nor do I. Good, thank you. So we'll move on to business items. The first item is the power supply analysis and updates. Mr. John Purvis. Go ahead, John.
Yes, Sean, would you enable screen share?
It should be enabled.
That's your screen, T. You need to turn your screen off.
Well, you should be able to share, but I will bring it up, John.
Yeah, T, I probably need to bring it up myself. I have notes.
Okay. How about
yes.
Now, John?
Yes, I see it now.
All right, thank you. Sorry about that.
Okay, is everyone seeing a PowerPoint that is power supply analysis 2/14/2022?
Yes. Yes, I see it. I like the tropical island better, John.
Yes, so do I. Okay, let me get a few things situated here. So basically, this power supply analysis is brought to you in part by board request last meeting, as well as some other topics that have been mentioned in the last few months, as well as a couple updates that staff leads believes we need to give the board on prior reporting. There's been a couple minor changes, or basically additions to what was conveyed in the board packet, primarily for clarity and understanding. So basically, the first thing before we get into a deep analysis, you know, we have to understand the BPA billing determinants. They are very complex and convoluted. They're not independent nor standalone. Interestingly, power and transmission are not entirely independent. For example, high load hours and low load hours are also major transmission determinants. So basically, the power and transmission are kind of melded in some sense. So basically, we have to deconstruct the BPA billing to find effective rates for any comparative analysis. And the effective rate includes a fixed monthly rate for each of 12 months, a two-tiered megawatt hour rate for high load hours for each individual month, as well as a single-tiered megawatt hour rate for low load hours for each of the 12 months. And from a forecasting standpoint, it's, these results are based on forecast or expected load. If you have unusual weather conditions, the billing determinants can change somewhat, but the base is the forecast load. So basically, using BP 22 effective rates, you can kind of, it's a very busy chart, but on the columns, the green is basically the proportion of low load hours. The blue is high load hours below contract demand, and the orange-pink color is high load hours above contract demand, and purple is unutilized load above contract demand. And by looking at these proportions, as well as taking a look at you know, the incremental cost at different stages, you come up with what is basically an effective composite fixed charge, the orange curve, that actually, you know, dips down negative in December, interestingly. And you also have a load hour curve that's green, as well as a high load hour below contract demand, as well as high load hours above contract demand shaped for forecast. And this black line is basically a composite for both power and transmission, floating around $40 a megawatt hour. The weights are on this side of the chart corresponding to the columns. The dollars are on this side corresponding to each of these individual costs. As you get further into it, you can identify the cost per megawatt hour during particular time increments. The one I have highlighted in yellow here is basically an incremental cost of a one average megawatt hour load, a constant load at high load hours. Now, if this is shaped due to the increment within the month, primarily by demand, it increases an amount to a substantially higher number here, if you follow my cursor. And once again, load hours are considerably less. And I want to make a point that the high load hours, not coincidental demand, down here, if you have additional high load hours that is not resulting in an increase in demand, the costs are very low. And during the prior rate case, BP20, it actually became negative for a couple months, which is not something I'm sure they intended to do, and it looked like they have remedied this in BP22. So it's really, really kind of interesting. But once you deconstruct the bill, you can come up with these effective, usable data. So basically, using this, we can determine the incremental Tier 1 cost of power, what can be referred to as the BP22 effective block rate. If you look at high load hours in total incremental, you have this amount. If you turn it into a constant addition, let's say a one average megawatt load, two, three, four, five average megawatt load, you can get this point. Plus, you also know what your high load hour shape is. Now, when I talk about shape here, it's not the conventional BPA shape where they do month by month. This is what I would refer to as the shape charge primarily due to demand within a single month. The shape for a BPA is more reflected in the baseline here as they go up and down for different months of the year. And we also have load hours, average megawatts. And here at the bottom, you have a weighted average for all of the months in the year, giving an effective block rate of 2277 and 2380 for high load hour and low load hour average megawatt, respectively. Okay, and at the same time, we can't forget transmission costs. They really, in a way, are blended. But to those power costs, of course, we would have to add the transmission costs. One thing to note, transmission costs for low load hours is very small compared to high load hours, where the traffic or density of the load is much higher. Okay, so basically what this incremental analysis shows us is not really cost effective to supplant Tier 1 with alternative market-based non-carbon block product unless high load hour incremental break-even is 2777 an average megawatt. Low load hour incremental break-even, average over the course of the year, is 23.8 average megawatt. And, of course, no matter what it is, there is a intra-monthly shaping charge associated for demand that averages out to $8.74 an average megawatt. Of course, we're not talking about transmission in this. This is the base power cost. Okay, now current market-based forward price curves now exceed $50 an average megawatt. And this has been a dramatic change over the last year. If we went back to this time last year, the forward price curves through 2020 and the first several months into 2021, let's say a year ago, was showing that we were looking at what was expected to be $24 an average megawatt at a 50% confidence and $38 an average megawatt lower than that at a 95% confidence. So really, when we look at $50 an average megawatt now, I would call that a miss by almost four standard deviations just 1 year ago. And we're going to try to get into a little bit of trying to see what's actually going on here. It was really surprising as we were looking at this through the summer and fall of last year and hoping it would go away, but it doesn't seem to be falling back to the historic norms. Okay, so market trends. In summary, BPA Tier 1 power has recently become substantially more competitive than market power. Mid-sea price trends and forecasts are no longer favorable with respect to cost. And we're actually looking at a diminishing spot market volume. We think that there's a regional trend toward forward market procurement and long-term renewable contracts, maybe kicked off somewhat by CETA impacts on IOUs as they try to line up non-carbon sources because they're on a tight timeline to get to no more than 20% of their supply is non-carbon or carbon emitting, and they're going to run up against that wall in 2030. Of course, we all know about the coal generation retirements. And also one element that became apparent last year were continuing poor hydro condition on the Western Interconnect, primarily in the Southwest California area. Those reservoirs were pretty much completely drained for most of the year, you know, near the historic lows. And, of course, there's hydro curtailments, fish mitigation that impacts both BPA and market either directly or via BPA secondary sales. Now, go ahead.
How did you determine that there's a diminishing spot market volume
I'm going to get into that.
Okay.
Okay, so basically, BPA Tier 2 cost follows mid-sea prices, which may offer future opportunities for serving above contract high watermark load. What I'm saying is, with high market prices, we're going to see high Tier 2 BPA costs that's going to make other power sources competitive with Tier 2 power in the future. So basically, just an overview of the spot market. This slide tries to show mid-sea on-peak prices for each month over the last 11 years. And previously, we could tie price spikes to specific weather conditions or events. And this isn't really the same anymore. We can't really pinpoint where the high prices are coming from like we used to be able to. And market volatility has had a profound impact on both BPA and PPC Aurora modeling within a single year. So basically, if you look at this, and you might want to look at the annual average, which is a weighted average for every month of the year here. And what you see is we've had sustained elevated cost of market power for most of 2021, continuing into 2022. And for last year, that would be the green columns here, the last year in each section. And we know we had a weather impact in February that contributed to high costs. But then starting in June, we had the summer impact, and it hasn't gone away. Prices have been really elevated, averaging $58 a megawatt hour over the course of the full year. And if you compare that to, let's say, last year, it's more than double. That was around $23 a megawatt hour. Back in 2019, it was $40 a megawatt hour average over the course of the year. So we're getting a lot more volatility. Plus, there may be an increase over several years, except for 2020, where it fell pretty low. Okay, so trying to dig into this, we are able to go back in EIA reporting to look at megawatt hours sold at the mid-sea hub going back any number of years. And one thing that is notable, especially if you take the monthly averages, weighted average, we've had as much as a 70% decline in power sold on the spot market over the last decade. So these margins, which are low now here, may not be as small as they seem, because in emergencies, energy can still be had, but such energy is very costly. And maybe a better way of looking at this is just putting it in a table. So this table, for the last, I guess, 11 years, we have the high load hour weighted average cost per watt hour per year, the average monthly high load hour market volume on the mid-sea, and then the fourth column I put the average monthly consumption in megawatt hours for the three states of Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. Now, there's not a direct correlation between the mid-sea and those three states, but those three states in total make up the overwhelming predominance of load that might be procured on the mid-sea. So if we look at prices, let's say here, this is historically, up and down, there's some volatility. But then when you get to the last 3 years, it's rather dramatic, meaning the variance that we're seeing is a lot more than what we saw previously, a lot less predictable. And if we look at the average monthly high load hour market volume in megawatt hours, you see it's been falling just about every year to a fraction of what it once was. Now, part of this is the BPA contract and going into the last contract caused some fundamental changes. But throughout the contract, these have continued to fall. And then if we look at the farmost right column, you see power consumption of the three states have been remarkably stable for more than a decade. if you looked at EIA reporting. It's pretty consistent between 13 and 14 million, I guess, megawatt hours average monthly consumption. Now, what's going on here? We did see a bump up in energy more than the average previously here. And this number had come down, and it did result in a bump up in power rates. Now, then in 2020, we did have a reduction in use, the actual low, close to a 5% reduction over the previous year, primarily due to COVID impacts. And when that happened, there was a dramatic, almost two to one reduction in power cost. Now, in 2021, there was a substantial, let's say, 6% increase in energy utilized within those three states, with a further reduction in the market volume, and we see a spike to $58 a megawatt hour for the year, which is far outside of what anybody anticipated. Now, yes?
A question on this column on the right, the average monthly comparison, Washington, Oregon, Idaho. Is that consumption from all resources in the Northwest or BPA?
No, that's all resources in the Northwest. I go to the EIA statistics and
okay.
sum up all consumption, industrial, commercial, residential. Okay, so basically this is telling me that the combination probably of a smaller volume as well as ups and downs in consumption is leading to fairly volatile prices. And this is atypical what we have seen in the past, especially the last 3 years. And we saw that in the prices. So what does this mean for the future? Okay, so BP24, Tier 2 costs can be approximated by Mid-C prices over the preceding 24 months, plus a scheduling or risk adder of several dollars a megawatt hour. Elevated Mid-C prices since April 2021 will be included in future BPA Tier 2 calculations. BP24 costs are very likely to exceed $45 a megawatt hour, which would be a 31% increase over BP22. And if we look at the Energy Authority, and I wanted to use one of their slides, but we're not a member, so I can't. But the Energy Authority has forward price curves that they say are stabilized between $40 and $55 a megawatt hour for each of the four next years. Okay, so the district is almost certainly to see a wholesale price power increase exceeding 3% in BP24 simply due to elevated Tier 2 costs. Now, on the other hand, if BPA sells surplus into high cost market, a Tier 1 decrease might largely offset the Tier 2 cost increase. Now, later in this presentation, we're going to get into PPC modeling, which suggests that this would be exactly the case. But like I say, this is somewhat speculative.
So, okay. John, can I ask a question?
Sure.
The TEA is an aggregator. So are they including renewables in this or not?
The TEA is just forecasting, and I think right now most of what TEA is forecasting is potentially carbon sources, hydro sources, and renewable sources. Now, when prices get as high as they are now on the market, it does make some renewable options more cost-effective comparably. So, how much of that is renewable, how much is carbon, I simply do not know. I do know that a year ago, they were still getting contracts for 2022 and 2023 in the upper $20 a megawatt hour for block.
Yeah, just for reference, Energy Northwest is assisting a solar developer, 120-megawatt facility. It could be 150, but it's constrained by transmission. And that was going to be $40 power, but then when you firm it up, when you back it up with 24/7, then it becomes $80 power. So.
Yeah, later on we're going to get into a discussion on another alternative for a somewhat lower cost renewable supply in this presentation. Okay, so basically,
let's see, the third bullet from the bottom, the district is likely to see a wholesale cost of power increase exceeding 3% due to elevated Tier 2 costs. Could you go into that just a little bit more?
Okay, so you're talking about this third bullet?
No, down third from the bottom, where it says the district.
Okay, so basically, if you look at the amount of Tier 2 we purchased, which is on the order of 4.5 average megawatts.
Okay, it's power. It's our Tier 2 purchases that we've been getting. All right, I get it.
Yeah, yes. Okay. And in the last bullet, unfortunately, when you do an election for Tier 2 power, you have to do it well in advance. So for BP24, we're already locked into what's going to be a high-cost power. The earliest future opportunity to make any changes for serving above contract high water mark load is BP26. So we're going to see an increase in tier two costs. We just don't know how high it's going to go.
Yep. So how does this, you know, at the meetings that WAPAG is holding in the PPC, they are talking about changing the contract high watermark from the 1937.
Yeah.
How would that impact this?
At the conclusion near the end of this presentation, I'm going to touch on that very point.
Okay, I'm sorry, John. We keep preempting you.
Oh, no problem. Okay, Strategic Planning Workshop, Future Power Supply Options in CETA, 9/14/2020. 17 months ago, we provided the board with a comprehensive overview of future power supply options in the context of CETA. Since that time, there's been some major changes, some of which we've talked about, some of which I'm going to talk about here shortly, impacting the prior analysis that warrants an update. Okay, in the previous presentation, we talked about wind and solar generation, distribution scale batteries, even some preliminary planning for that. As well, we touched on small modular reactor and developments in nuclear. Okay, recently it was brought to our attention there was an offering on wind and solar based in Oregon, I believe. Yeah, UM 2059-2020, all source requests for proposals. And Pacific Power showed average bid scores of just a little over $27 and $30 a megawatt hour bus price for solar and wind generation.
Is that firm, John?
No, this is a bus price. So,
okay.
So, but these are considerably lower than what Western Washington was looking at the year previously associated with Energy Northwest, which quoted a price at the time between $30 and $40 a megawatt hour, which more recently has lined out closer to the $40 a megawatt hour. Of course, that's before any additions for shaping and RSS.
What did you mean by best price? Did you mean average bid score or?
No, the average bid score that we're looking at here for the Oregon projects came out at $20 and $30. Now, I tried to find specific details on the particulars, and it was one of wasn't readily available in public information.
You hit the average there.
Yes, the average.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so basically these Oregon projects are the most competitive Pacific Northwest renewable offerings to date. Now, on the solar, there would be a little bit of a penalty due to the Clallam shape versus the generation of the solar. And that's primarily due to the displacement of BPA power in the summertime, which on average is a little bit lower than what would be in the wintertime when the solar is not producing nearly as much. And that penalty is about $2.28 per megawatt hour. Now, BPA, of course, is going to assess RSS cost for their customers, including shipping, based on prior analysis. We expect these to be in the neighborhood of $16 a megawatt hour for both the solar and wind. And that's basically to firm up and shape the power for what would be us or anyone else's load. Okay, our previous presentation, we illustrated the cost of solar generations as well as transmission based on location in East and West Washington as well as the Desert Southwest. And this more recent offerings are probably, in all likelihood, based out of South Central Oregon, where the solar radiation is significantly improved upon even the Eastern Washington. So basically, once again, down here in the Mojave Desert, we're looking at 8 kilowatts per meter square. And when you get up to here in Western Washington, we're looking at about half of that. A little bit better in East Washington, and then even better in Oregon. So I would say this Oregon project is maybe halfway between what we'd see here in Western Washington versus what you get in the Desert Southwest for the solar farms down there. Of course, as I mentioned last time, the further away it is, the higher cost of the transmission. And sometimes transmission is cost prohibitive, and there's some capacity charges that come into play, especially as you go from one region to another. Okay, so in summary, let's go back to our incremental cost of analysis of BP22. If we look at the high load hour tier one rate, we have power, we have shaping within a month, and then we have transmission for an incremental cost of $42.61. Incremental light load hours are considerably lower at $24.80. The weighted incremental cost, $35.93. And you might ask, well, why is that cheaper than the base for BPA? That's because, remember, I said there is an effective fixed cost that's pronounced in the summertime. It pretty much goes away in the wintertime. And let's compare that to what we have now. We have Packwood Hydro. Now, we procured Packwood Hydro quite a few years back in anticipating of elevated cost, but it's considerably more expensive than the BPA alternatives, at least on an incremental level. The base cost is about $40 a megawatt hour. BPA assigns even to Hydro an RSS and shaping cost of about $810. Of course, we have the transmission cost here, an average transmission cost, totaling $52.17. If we look at BP 22 Tier 2, that's fairly economical now and has been for the last several rate cases. We go back a couple more, it was a lot higher. Even the vintage rates, we saw dollars exceeding 50 and even more per megawatt hour. But if we put it together, 38.60, which is fairly economical, a little bit more than tier one incremental cost, but that was based on a spot market where BPA buys most of the power for tier two that was fairly low. Now, when we look at BP24, remember I said the power cost, which includes the RSS and shaping, is going to be $45 at least. And if we look at TEA, it could be, if prices stay high as $55. Tack on the transmission cost, we're looking at $50 and $60 megawatt hour for Tier 2 supply, which is back where we were 10 years ago, looking forward. So if we compare the recent solar offering and wind offering, of course, BPA is going to put substantial RSS on those to firm it up and shape it. Plus, it's coming from a little bit farther away in Oregon, so our staff estimates suggest that transmission will be a little bit elevated. So we're looking at $53, $54 a megawatt hour, which is actually pretty comparable to what we're getting for Packwood at $52. And if we go back to our last year's analysis of the small modular reactor, of course, that's a little bit over $60 a megawatt hour. But even that would be assessed shaping charge because it's essentially a constant load. But the transmission cost going to, let's say, Western Idaho would not be as much, we think, as South Central Oregon. Things to take away here is that these alternatives here, non-carbon emitting, start looking competitive with BPA Tier 2 if we see these increases, which are expected. At the same time, it shows the incremental cost of BPA Tier 1 is really a lot lower than all of these, substantially so.
And so the transmission you mentioned coming from Idaho, that's the NuScale case?
Yes, sir. When we looked at this at that time, we assumed something like that. If it was located closer, like one of the small modular, one of the utilities is looking at, it would be substantially less.
Grant's looking at an SMR, and they're also looking at putting it in their service territory. So that would cut that number down by what?
You know, I wouldn't say dramatically, but perhaps 350.
Not a huge.
And these costs are based on, there's a little bit of an intermittent penalty on these wind and solar costs. I think it's about a quarter for solar and maybe three quarters for wind, in addition to the distance. Now, when you said that the Energy Northwest project was looking at, you know, something more than that, you know, this is staff estimate, and I'll be honest with you, we are not experts in point-to-point transmission and unusual contracts. We're a low-following customer. But I do believe that if we brought this power on as a low-following customer serving above contract high watermark load, we're probably in the ballpark. But this $7.06 plus or minus a couple of dollars, We're not going to be spot on without doing a really complex evaluation, probably going to outside resources to do the analysis. But we're definitely in the ballpark here. Okay, summary, to bring on a new dedicated source to serve above contract high watermark load, as I said, requires advance notice. BP-26 is the first future opportunity. BP-24 is done. We're already going to see those costs. It is unlikely we'll want to bring on a new dedicated resource to supplant Tier 1 in a future contract, primarily because you look at the alternatives that are packed with, which is pretty cost-effective hydro outside of BPA. Net's about $16 a megawatt hour higher than the current BPA composite incremental rate. And the latest renewable offerings have high differentials as well. And one thing to really pay attention to, and we saw this with our packwood procurement, once a resource is dedicated, BPA Tier 1 is lost for the life of the oncoming project in most cases. So, you know, you got to be careful in the face of high market prices. You don't want to let go of BPA Tier 1 if you expect increasing or high prices in the future. Now, on the other hand, part of our packwood is serving Tier 2, which is actually a good thing if Tier 2 prices increase. A portion of packwood is actually offsetting Tier 2, which is much more favorable. Okay, expected rise in Tier 2 costs will likely make alternatives for serving above contact high watermark load cost effective, including renewable options. And as we get into BP 26, and especially the new contract with CETA, we're going to have to be looking at opportunities outside of BPA if BPA does not look for those opportunities within, you know, their service. If they stick to a market-based solution to Tier 2, we're going to have to look elsewhere. Okay, buying power is complex, requires outside expertise. We do not know a whole lot about that. We have, we've been a low-falling customer for many, many years. But procurement does require memberships in organizations with similar functions to Northwest Requirements Utilities, NRU, Northwest Energy Management Services, NEMS. They specialize in above contract high watermark procurement. And even the Energy Authority, one of several, it's abbreviated T, but one of several trading and management companies associated primarily with Slice Block. And these costs can be several dollars per megawatt hour over and above forward market contracts. So if the forward market is 24, and I'm guessing a couple, $3 more than that when you put all the additional overhead costs to perform these functions. So even with procurement cost, power can usually be procured several dollars below BPA Tier 2 rate, but with substantial downside risk in volatile markets as has recently occurred. So we have to be careful. On average, you can save a couple dollars a megawatt hour by going outside of BPA Tier 2, but you do have some downside risk in unusually volatile markets. And another thing, we got to remember the receipt above contract high watermark load will eventually need to be non-carbon. Okay, changing gears, recent battery trends. Okay, in the previous presentation, we introduced how distribution scale batteries might integrate with BPA to reduce demand charges, and it appeared we were getting close to a break even on cost benefits. Basically, in our application, a significant distribution scale battery could peak shave and lower demand charges and basically save us money, almost enough money to pay for the battery cost itself. Okay, we looked at a distribution scale battery, 5 megawatt, 20 megawatt hours. We were looking at cost recovery through a reduction in BPA demand charges. And at that time, projected economic viability in 24 to 26 timeframe based on BP 20 analysis and projected declining battery component costs. Now, unexpectedly, cost analysis using BP 22 resulted in a net lowering of demand charges for most months compared to BP 20. When we updated our analysis using BP 22, cost recovery was $455,000 a year compared to the previous $538,000 a year. That was truly unexpected. In all years leading up to BP 22 and including BP 22, the demand charges had increased. Now, remember I mentioned earlier in one of the charts first showed that there was a negative price in BP 20 and very low cost for BP 22 for high load hour that is not coincidental to demand. I personally think that plays into it. BPA realized that they were offering their consumers to use energy and actually lower their bill, and they had to remedy that. And part of that remedy was BPA demand charges, and we have hence less of an impact due to the demand and lower recovery. Now, the primary adverse problem we're seeing is battery cost trends due to COVID manufacturing supply chain issues that may be more than transitory. The previous analysis used NREL's mean case for lithium ion battery cost. The size that they had were 60 megawatts. We were looking at something substantially smaller, but we were thinking we would see battery trends that were comparable for lithium battery costs. Unfortunately, InRoad hasn't updated the literature, but lithium carbonate prices have increased nonfold since our 2020 analysis. And I show here, at the time of our analysis, lithium carbonate prices down to $40,000 per metric ton, and it stayed low for a little while, but it's ramping up. It's up to $380 $1,000 per metric ton. Once again, ninefold price. This is going to have great, significant impacts on vehicle electrification, cost of electric vehicles, and also it's going to affect the economic viability of our planned distribution scale battery project that we're planning for. And it's very likely to be pushed out due to higher project costs and lower cost recovery. Now, we're still hoping that these battery costs are transitory, but it's beginning to look like maybe not. And if not, an alternative CETA project may be needed in the near future. Okay, another topic that we wanted to get into due to request, PPC gave a presentation on a Tier 1 system size analysis overview, and Will, you'd inquired about this, I believe, as well as some WAPAC stuff further on, but staff thought clarification and comments were needed associated with the PPC presentation, primarily because it simply was not well annotated with what they were trying to show. So one of the slides they presented was Aurora modeling comparing BP22 conducted in 2020 versus PPC conducted in 2021. Now, on this chart, they simply select an average market price that was arbitrarily set to $100 a megawatt hour. And if you look on the left side, the BP22 case, you had an upside and downside variance that was balanced. And the more recent analysis by PPC, and probably impacted somewhat primarily by the market, is seeing an upside greater than downside variance, and it's an expanded variance for the P10 and P90 cases, even though the averages stay the same. This signifies substantially more volatility. Also, there was a graph that wasn't very well annotated that PPC system modeling that showed using the orange line system output average, an average watt a year, the orange. Also, system obligations or requirements, and as well as a dashed line showing the 1937 critical water year. The shaded area represents the mean generation over requirements in an average water year, keeping in mind that if you have a good water year, that orange line is going to be substantially higher. And if you have a poor water year, you're going to perhaps approach the critical water year. Now, don't make a mistake if you look at requirements to generation. In reality, our contract for Tier 1 is based on the dashed line. So, currently an average water year will meet all system requirements, but in a critical water year, that's the basis of our current Tier 1, there is a deficit for several months starting in December and running through March. Now, the next, the secondary sales is not really related to the shaded area. It would be a shaded area between the dashed line and the orange line for an average water year.
So this talk of trying to change the critical water year, the 1937 thing, do we have any idea what kind of impact that would have?
Yes, we will, and you're going to have to wait a little bit longer. Will, we're going to get into that later in this. And
I'm
also
not going to ask again because you got it all covered. Okay,
okay.
Thank you.
Now, one thing to note here, the PPC presentation, I'm not going to show that slide, said that the base was 6563 megawatts. So in this slide, at least, the dashed line does include the Columbia generation as well. Okay, the next slide is actually showing the same thing probabilistically of the previous slide, which is showing the shaded area in the form of probabilities distribution. And what we didn't like about this slide is we just didn't understand what everything was at the time. The blocks are represented by the 25th and 75th percentile, and the whiskers in this plot is the 1% and 99 percentile. There's also an X in it, which represents the mean, and a line that represents the median in the chart. It's good to know that. And outliers, which fall outside of the 1 and 99 percentiles, which seem to occur almost exclusively over 5 months, starting in August and running through December. There's very occasional points that fall on the low end. That's interesting. These are based on 32,000 monthly model points, so whatever analysis they're doing of order conditions and markets for each month, I assume that they're looking at 3,200 data points. Okay, this is a chart that was very confusing when they presented. I don't think anyone really got it because there wasn't enough there. You had to really look at it and ask questions, but we did follow up. It does appear these lines are based on mean water year. We also see a negative correlation between Tier 1 and market due to secondary sales that decline as Tier 1 size increase. And that's part of the discussion in WAPAG and PPC and talking to BPA. The customers are saying, well, where are we going to set a Tier 1 size other than the past practice of critical water year? And there's advantages for our utility, we believe, for setting it at a higher amount. Keep in mind, BPA has to procure power to supplement Tier 1 regardless of the water year, because they're based on monthly averages, really an accounting construct, which I think everyone understands now. So basically, this chart also shows that during a poor water year, it's not shown on the chart, but during a poor water year, there's an upward bias in both lines. So these costs, both market and the low price and high prices, will tend to go up in a poor water year and go down in a good, favorable water year. Now, there is an implication here that Tier 1 and Tier 2 have a negative correlation. And that becomes very important when you have principles that you want to absolutely minimize the cost of Tier 1, because when you do that, you're creating more exposure for utilities subject to Tier 2. And you see that, and it's in this chart, basically. A lowest Tier 1 rate implies higher Tier 2 rate. And that may not be in the interest of our utility if we want to get lowest cost power. This will further be expanded upon in the WAPAG presentation. So Ryan's given this presentation here on the 2028 concept paper. And I'm going to go over a little bit and what it means to us and maybe ask a few questions. You know, critical firm power, this was presented, and it's rather interesting. Ryan is really focusing on maybe perhaps setting a Tier 1 size of about 7,400 average megawatts, which would be substantially above what is now critical water, at least for 2023, which is 6670. And one of his questions was, do you favor fixing critical firm power for the duration of the upcoming contract or continue with the current process? Now, staff believes, yes, we would like to do that because it transfers risk away from utilities like ours that are not well positioned to deal with the risk and places it back on BPA to augment their system as needed to serve load, which is their obligation. And they go, Ryan goes over several reasons, but the one we're focused on is this last, may prompt BPA to put more thought into market purchases or system augmentation. And we consider this the utmost importance due to our portion of load served by Tier 2, which is higher than most other utilities. So if the board does not object, we would like to convey our position to WAPAG on this, as yes, we would like to look at an average as opposed to something that's going up and down rather unpredictably year to year. It would help in our planning if we were to consider serving above high, you know, contract high watermark load from a source other than BPA. Also, a major focus for Ryan is contract high watermark options. Option one, keep it the same as done in the past going forward. And our position is, compared to most other customers, Clallam would be allocated a lower portion of Tier 1 compared to requirements, as is the case now. And this would be the worst option, especially with market power being so high and probably going to stay there for a few years, perhaps even into the next contract. Option two is to fully reallocate contract high watermarks to be used starting with the first rate period under the new contract based on updated loads and resources. Now, almost all customers will receive a Tier 1 allocation that is proportional to the requirements at the onset of the contract, substantially increasing our portion of load served by Tier 1. We believe this is the best and most fair option, because any contractual arrangement in an expired contract really can't be brought forth in a new contract unless there's really universal agreement to do so. Option three is trying to, you know, split the baby, Ryan says. It's a compromise that retains but partially mitigates the disparities of option one. Option four, this is the option where they are looking at resizing the Tier 1 system to some number above critical water. And originally, they were looking at low cost or lowest Tier 1 cost, but as we saw on the previous slide, that's not necessarily the case, but it may be good for us because of the impact of getting rid or initially almost eliminating our Tier 2 obligation. So very complex and conditional upon several assumptions, including system augmentation or resizing arbitrarily the systems to something more than critical water. It's not as favorable to us as option two unless Tier 1 is significantly augmented and likely the only current option that will garner a substantial majority of public power support. You got to remember, it's about half the utilities are not subject to Tier 2, half are, and when they do this, you have winners and losers in similar proportions. So you're not going to get agreement for option one or option two from, you know, the majority of customers. This might be a way to do so in a way that's favorable to the great majority of customers, and we would entertain this as a recommendation.
So, John, you're looking, WAPAG and PPC are putting together a public power position paper. You're looking for which of these we should support, and we might emphasize that we can't unilaterally negotiate contracts upon a bill. It's good. We got to influence this process up front.
Yeah, so basically this is, you know, we're looking at providing information to WAPAG of what we believe is the best option for our utility based on this analysis and what makes sense to us. So we're not going to be communicating this to BPA. I'm thinking more in lines of, you know, making our position better known to WAPAG, that we have option two as our preference. Option four may work. Option one will not work as is unfair. And option three is arbitrary, and we don't see why anyone would consider that. And then there's another fifth option that BPA came out, which is kind of similar to option three, where they allocate half of the headroom of other utilities to give to utilities that are tier two. But that's a totally arbitrary, much like the rest of the options, arbitrary and probably overly complex. It's a BPA way of doing things, but I personally don't like it. I don't see what the advantage is any different between that and option three, which is you know, splitting in half. It's almost similar to option three. So once again, if the board does not object, we'd like to continue to convey that option two is preferred, but depending on details, we may also consider something along the lines of option four as being favorable.
Okay. You're not through. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So staff recommendation on BPA 2028, we're trying to simplify this. We would recommend seeking the lowest future cost power supply options and technologies while conforming to CETA carbon requirements. Based on current information, market conditions, Aurora modeling, this will require, as we go into the contract, of trying to maximize the share of Tier 1 with no reduction in our net requirements served by BPA. And on the other hand, in a high-cost market environment, we will need to seek to minimize Tier 2 requirements and may have to look to non-BPA options to serve Tier 2 load, perhaps sooner than the future contract, BP26, as early as BP26, especially if the Energy Authority, TEA, forward price curves continue to range between $45 and $55 for the next 4 years.
Hey.
So,
go ahead, John.
I guess that's pretty much it. I'd like a little bit of guidance from the board on some of these questions for WAPAG as well as our staff recommendation.
Okay, questions, comments?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I got plenty of questions. I guess which ones really were germane to what you're trying to decide here, John? You've given us basically three or four different presentations, and I realize each one of them had a specific outcome in mind with information, but I'm seeing things between them, though, that are hard to follow. The market conditions, what the PPC Aurora modeling shows versus maybe what the Power Council's Genesis model showed, at least for the next 5 years, and I suppose the Aurora modeling was a longer duration if it's looking at 2028. For instance, that chart you showed that PPC did where you have the convergence of the two lines, the prices, though, are still I can't correlate those prices with what you told us earlier about where it's out here, where mid-C was, when you did the cost analysis on the meeting CETA with wind, solar, batteries, and the analysis there. Should I just take those as two separate sets of information and data and not try to correlate them in any way?
Jim, there is a correlation. So basically, the Aurora modeling and even the work of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council was based on data prior to 2021. The PTC modeling introduced the data for 2021, and they started doing this mid-year, and they started getting very unexpected results from their modeling with the unusually high market prices, mid-C prices, as well as what they were seeing in the forward price curves. So basically, in a way, you could almost look at this chart as high prices and volume here. You know, we're currently, if we're just looking at 2021, now this is probably a mean water year, and this could go up in a poor water year. But in 2021, we're looking at this, something a little bit north of this blue line. If you're looking at 19 and 20, you're looking at something here below this orange line. So basically, when PPC did their modeling, I believe they were initially expecting pretty much what BPA saw in their 2022 rate case based on 2020 modeling. With the new market information, I remember Ryan saying early that there was a sweet spot at 70 at a tier one size of about 7,400. Unfortunately, that changed, and that changed primarily due to this low, high prices and volume here. And when this started coming in, that made a radical change. These lines don't converge. As a matter of fact, if you want to look at your lowest tier one cost, you'd make it very small, run this down here, and subsidize what we get by BPA secondary sales. But that doesn't make sense. So then going back to here, we see increased volatility. The only difference between this and this, using the same Aurora modeling, is a single year of market data. So basically, higher upside compared to downside, and more importantly, just a wider variance or illustration of volatility, which is consistent with what we saw in the mid-sea markets. Here. I mean, no, this is pretty sustained for 2021, and even today, as early as February, we're still seeing high load hours running $40 to $60. I mean, it even hadn't come down yet, even so far this year. And this is a strong indication that, you know, market prices are not going to return to the $24. Well, where did I put that? $24 a megawatt hour here. Not when all the forward price curves for the next 4 years are running $45 to $55. It's not a one-year deal. Plus, it tells us that the volatility might return within a year or two, but it tells us that the mere fact that we went from $24 to $50 for a forward price curve in less than a year tells us we could go back down to 24 pretty easily, but it tells us our volatility is not what it used to be with, go back forward, when we were dealing with this time period where things were very predictable. It's now going to be unpredictable. Here in a year or two, maybe if things go well and the economy is not too good, we might see $25 a megawatt hour. If things really take off, we're going to be pushing $58 a megawatt hour.
Yeah, and I guess that begs the question. If, you know, we're trying to model something that they're admitting has high volatility, and yet we're using that modeling result anyway to make some decisions on.
What would you suggest, Jim?
Well, I don't know. I'm asking what are these, the people that are putting this together, what are they thinking about this volatility and what has caused it and what's going on today and what's likely to cause more volatility or less volatility in the future?
Well, I personally think the underlying, there is hydro issues in the Southwest, but over the next several years, we have, you know, decarbonization. That's going to have a big impact. We're going to have future coal retirements, and there's no investment in California. It's common to have development of new peaking natural gas generation to balance intermittent renewables. And we're not seeing that here, probably because we have substantial hydro, but that does add some, you know, unknowns and uncertainty. We also going to, you know, as we get a high spot market prices, it's going to make renewables serving load for most customers, say take public power and customers receiving BPA, is going to make it more competitive for those companies to serve that load, their loads, with renewables as long as it can be firmed and balanced. And BPA has that capability on a regional level, but I'm not sure how much that expands to the region in total. BPA has the ability to firm up and shape a lot of renewable, but it's not very well integrated. So there's a lot of unknowns. Now, if you look at the Northwest Power and Conservation Council, they're making some assumptions, which may be valid, that, yes, if things are integrated and coordinated, you can bring on substantial intermittent renewables. But, you know, that is going to take time, and BPA is going to have to make adjustments. Now, that's a worldview beyond, you know, at least what staff here is, you know, particularly concerned with. We're looking at what do we do in BP 26, what do we do in the new contract in 2028, when we know that we have all the experts who are looking at this and forecasting $26, $27, $28 forward price curves out into the distant future were terribly wrong based on 1 year. So the experts were extremely wrong. And that's concerning us because of the volatility and the consequences of what we're going to be exposed.
Okay, and I can, but again, the impact for us is that this volatility affects us through our purchase of Tier 2 power to make up for the difference between what we get from Tier 1.
Correct. Yeah, okay, that is one thing.
So that's what percentage is that? Of our total?
Our total requirement is about 76 to 77 average megawatts. Our tier two portion is about 4.5 megawatts and increasing. Or looks like it's increasing. It's gone from 2.5, 4, 4.5. I'm not sure of the exact number. A small portion of that is taken up by Packwood. Now, one thing that we're nervous about, we're a load-following utility. You have PPC and WPAG and a lot of slice block customers who are the principal in negotiations with BPA trying to minimize and get the lowest Tier 1 cost. Now, we do know based on these recent presentations, Tier 1 and Tier 2 are negative correlations. That means if we get the absolute lowest Tier 1 cost, we're exposed to higher Tier 2. That's why we're also looking at that option 4, because that is a way out of the gate to eliminate our Tier 2 requirement by expanding the Tier 1 size. Now, if we go to option 2, where they reshuffle the deck, that puts every utility in the same place with respect to Tier 2 with respect to requirements. And that's something we have to pay attention to, because all the utilities with the deep pockets, big interests, slice block, dealing with the markets, as a load following customer BPA, we do not want to be left in the position that BPA is simply providing our Tier 2 at the spot market price, whatever it is, without any thought or intelligence going into the market purchase.
I'd be a good time to mention Clark's experience with their River Road natural gas-fired facility. You know, they built that thing some years ago as a dedicated resource. They, given the natural gas prices have been very, very low. They haven't had a rate increase in 8 years, but that's going away with CETA. I guess my point is volatility is always going to be there. And, you know, with the build out of electrification of transportation, electrification of buildings, and all those requirements coming out of the legislature, it's always going to, you've got to have a high degree of unknown. So we've got to take our best shot at this.
Yeah. I appreciate what you said there. What the thing, though, is a lot of these things we're talking about, carbon decarbonization, taking carbon, you know, coal plants or gas plants out or something like that, I don't see that as volatility. That's understood that you can put those losses into a model and generate it. But the volatility we're seeing here is way beyond what you know you can account for in those things that you can actually project and model.
Well, I guess my point is that volatility is going to be a fact of life, so we have to try mitigate that as much as possible, but you're never going to get it perfect. You know, well, the old saying about projecting into the future, you're always going to be wrong.
Right, I know, but we took a 4-year projection and we're going to make, you know, basically making decisions off of that.
Well, that's what we're concerned about. A 1-year change in a projection that is more than 2 to 1 in cost undermines all prior projections.
Right.
It's disturbing. It really is. And I'm looking at this, and it's got to be based on, I believe, this numbers declining and changes here. I mean, this was a 5% decline and a 6% increase. 5% decline, 6% increase. I would not have expected this variance because historically we dealt with this. So
and I guess, you know, I have to keep straight what we're talking about here. We're talking about this chart is for regional, but for BPA, you know, it's a different set of numbers. And I'm still trying, because, you know, one of the meetings here a couple of weeks ago, they had the resource adequacy workshop with BPA, and they presented some slides. And that were also generated a lot of question about how much, you know, what the surplus deficit is. And, you know, given the fact that they're up to 6,000 megawatts of surplus at certain times of the year. And then what's in those numbers? And that was really the confusing part. What's really in those numbers? And I talked to Steve Belkoff at BPA about that. And he was not even sure. I mean, he couldn't even tell me, for instance, what percentage of power leaving the authority area, going to California, was actually in a contract versus spot market. He did know that the amount of contract was very low, but he couldn't tell me. You know, he said, "Well, I don't know what the spot. You know, how much of that is spot market for them?" And so it was kind of a, it was very difficult in any of these presentations to, you know, really see a lot of, not even a lot, but some sense of consistency among them that we could, you know, okay, this seems to be working here or this isn't.
So I think we need to point out that I think what John is asking us for, He's done an analysis which is coming up with the best options for Clallam PUD, and that's going to be fed back to the WAPAG PPC positions that they're going to take to Bonneville. Are we outliers here, John, or are we pretty well
No, I think we haven't. We have the same commonality of load following BPA customers with a substantial tier two obligation. So,
okay.
So the first question is, we believe that to Ryan's specific inquiry, do you favor fixing critical firm power for the duration of the upcoming contract or continue the current process? We want to, you know, take the average and fix it for the contract. That helps dramatically in planning so that we don't have to worry about these variations.
Yeah.
Because when you're trying to come up with a tier two contract, how can you do it with this variation for the type of load we're looking for?
Well, I'll give you a thumbs up on that one.
Yes, I can too, and I thought we already did that a couple of weeks ago, but that's fine.
No, we want to make sure that was, and then, and here if we have these five options, our preference is option two, because it's fair and it's advantageous to us, but also we would entertain, depending on details, option four, if the tier one system is significantly augmented. And those are the two options that are palatable to our organization compared to the other options presented.
Okay. Well, I'll give you a thumbs up on that one.
Me too.
Yeah.
And lastly, for an overarching, and I'm going to call this Plylum PUD principles. They like to talk about principles at the PPC. And our principles are aligned with our current strategic plan to seek the lowest future cost power supply options and technologies while conforming to CETA carbon requirements. And then part of that looks like, for now, maximizing our share of Tier 1, which is indicative of what we requested and you agreed to on options. But also at the same time, we got to consider looking outside of BPA for Tier 2, especially if BPA is not going to provide a cost-competitive Tier 2 product in the next rate case or in the next contract.
So another option might be if Grant builds an SMR and they're going to offer power sales contracts to public power, that might fit here.
It might. As a matter of fact, that's why I showed the recent solar and wind opportunity in Oregon as well as the SMR.
Yeah.
Those costs are pretty competitive with what Tier 2 might be here in a couple years.
Okay, so this is a tricky one, though, because now you're basically saying something that's going to have implications over 25 years if we make this decision today, say. And given what we just said about volatility and all these other changes that are more or less, you know, you can foresee them coming, you just don't know the magnitudes, this becomes very problematic if we, you know, based on current information, market conditions, and modeling, we, you know, we're going to maximize our share. The other one is, of course, is we're still in a situation with BPA where we don't have a good method of projecting their actual cost of the hydro system, nor do we have a good system in place, although it's been suggested, of monitoring their cost and capital investments and stuff like that. And I also point this out because in the meeting last week on financial management, you know, they gave a presentation again, the second one in a year on asset management. And this one was worse. I mean, well, I won't say worse, but was provided less information than they did almost a year ago. And essentially, we've got an asset management where we're going to manage tens of thousands of resources, but we can't really tell you which of, you know, how our hydro system project by project is stacking up and which, you know, and how to make, you know, which ones are the real priorities and where we ought to be investing money. So this one, this number one, this first bullet here is to me one that I'm not sure that I would want to certainly not commit to today.
I move that we adopt a general principle that for our power supply going forward, we're looking for two things, CETA approved and lowest cost.
I can't argue with that.
I can't argue with that either.
So that's good.
Okay, we're going to go with this. And I did include qualification in this. For example, may have to look for non-BPA options based on current information. Information changes. You know, next year we might be looking at something totally different. So these two bullet points are just what the snapshot today looks like. This is the principle.
Yeah, okay. I'm good with the principle. But the first bullet especially, it's got so many ifs, ands, and buts.
Yeah, I do. I mean, we'll go with that, that it will be continually evaluated as we have done so. But this principle here is what we'll go with going forward. Okay, well, I appreciate it. I'm sorry I ran a little bit long.
Okay, John, thank you for the great presentation. Good job. Okay, we've talked about WAPAG. I'm not too sure, but we have a lot in this next agenda item of post 2028 contract discussion. Has anybody got something they want to say there? I'm kind of looking at a break.
Well, I mentioned one of the meetings was the financial management, and I've covered the key point there, asset management. The BPA also had last week a quarterly IPR. They're really looking good so far on cash on hand and on so forth, but they were cautious that it's early in the year, water years are, you know, we don't know what's going to happen and so forth. And in fact, last time I checked, prices were negative in California at the interchange. So, who knows what the rest of the year will hold there. So I think that, yeah, we pretty much covered it in the discussion already, all the other meetings I attended.
Okay, so, BPA has reported that snowpack is very good, above average, and anticipating high water. So who knows what, again, we get volatility, but... So anyway, all right, so we're done with that item?
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, let's take a five-minute break since John went way over his allocated time. I'm joking, John. You did fine.
Well, we probably needed twice as much time for that.
Yeah, we probably need days. So let's come back here at 3:03. How's that? Sean, you have provider of choice education letter.
Yeah, so this is a board action item from the January 24th meeting. As you recall, Commissioner Ozias with McClellan County made a public comment related to the BPA provider of choice contract. And we also received letters from the City of Port Angeles, City of Forks, and the Port of Port Angeles regarding that same topic. And I was originally going to include the letters in your board packet today, but Commissioner Waddell asked that I send them out well in advance. So I sent all of you an email on February 3rd with a copy of the suggested letter. And so I'm just here to get approval on the letter or see if you have any suggested edits.
Yeah, Sean, I think that was a great letter. It hit all the spots of informing, educating, and what the process is all about. So,
I think that was a good letter, and I think we should send it just the way it is.
Well, actually, I don't think we answered the mail. They asked specifically asked for meetings, and we didn't even address that. And at the last meeting, we agreed to have some sort of workshop or stakeholder forum where we would present some of this information and give them a chance to hear it, respond to it. So I think it's I think we really should be open to you know, hearing from, and this isn't just the, quote, public, you know, individuals. These are elected officials that represent a lot of our ratepayers, and I think we ought to be leaning a little bit forward on this, or not even leading forward, but just simply responding to the request.
Well, I think what we're doing, you know, of course, we're going to have meetings in the public forum. We're going to discuss this just as we just did in a public meeting. So I don't know, it would be a little redundant to even say that. That's kind of part of the process. So anyway, I would move that we go ahead and approve this letter and move it forward.
I second that.
Okay. It's been moved and seconded to go ahead and send this letter out. And anybody, let's...
Well, I disagree with the letter as written.
Right, good. Well, you'll hold a formal vote. I vote yes.
I vote yes.
Okay. Let's go ahead and send it, Sean. I think we're good. Okay. Is that all you had, Sean?
Yeah, that's all I had on that topic.
Okay, good. Next item is commissioner reports. Jim, we've kind of let the cat out of the bag here, but go ahead if you have something new.
Let's see. Let me just double check my a lot of stuff since our last board meeting. Public power meeting that was covered, the BPA financial workshop, WAPAG, power and conservation power committee, EDC, and BPA's quarterly business review. So those are the meetings I attended. Pretty much everything's remained relevant or worth talking about. We just talked about in the previous discussions.
Okay. Rick, did you have something?
Yes, sir. I went to a meeting for the Northwest River Partners, and they put on a very good meeting. They have talked about their five-year plan. They talked about their pro-Lower Snake River Dam plan, and I really commended them on doing a great job and trying to get out there and dispute a lot of false information that's been put out by other folks. I was also, I think that's at a WAPAG meeting, but I think I've already covered that, so that's all I've got.
Okay, thank you. Yes, I was also at the WAPAG meeting. I think we've covered that one thoroughly. Energy Northwest Executive Board met in a virtual meeting on the 26th. We normally go to Olympia so we can hobnob with the legislators and lobby them, but there seemed to be some concern over the new variant, so we made it all virtual. We did have some legislators come in and give talks, which was good. The CEO report, there are 321 cases of COVID at the plant. Vaccination is encouraged but not required, and it had no operational impact. Most of these were very minor cases, and people were able to isolate and still work virtually. They're working with a union contract with the nuclear workers and the security staff. They performed a survey of employees, 84% participation, and overwhelmingly satisfied with their jobs and how things are conducted there at Energy Northwest. During the cold snap we had around Christmas, there was a no-touch from BPA, which means that you can't even take a wrench into the plant, and that's not unusual in extreme weather conditions. What else happened here? They had a major cyber attack, which was defeated, and they did capture an IP address, and they're turning it over for investigation. They think it came from Russia, so I guess that kind of stuff's already started. The vitrification plant there on Hanford is due to start up shortly. They are going to, you know, they need large amount of heat for that process, and they're presently using fuel oil, and it's a huge requirement for fuel oil. So what we're talking to Department of Energy about putting a small modular reactor there to satisfy that electric load. So that might be an opportunity going forward. There were discussions with John Hairston, and specifically what we were talking about was the Energy Northwest budget going forward, and also talking about the extended power uprate of Columbia. We can do get an additional 200 megawatts out of the plant if we do some modifications, and we also have a license extension coming up, which we have to start working on. EPA is pretty receptive on these things. They're, of course, we have to do volumes of analysis and so on going forward, but that's looking pretty good. And I guess I'll just say that if you're going to uprate the plant, then you certainly need to extend the license. That extension, the cost of that uprate would be a payback of about 8 years. As far as the ES&D part of Energy Northwest, they received grants from the Department of Commerce for smart building and for demand side management. I've already talked about Ruby Flats, the solar facility, so that's good. As far as electric vehicles, Energy Northwest is purchasing 6 additional charging stations from green lots, and actually Shell Oil is purchasing charging stations from green lots as well. On the west side, I always ask this question because it's been around for a while, to put in charging stations on the Highway 101 loop, and they're looking at that and trying to get funding for that as well. Let's see. We had Representative Onke, B-O-C-H-K-E, from Tri-Cities area. A very impressive guy. He's well-founded, business background, and I told him that if I lived over there, I'd vote for him. What else we got here? There's going to be a new bond issue coming up, and part of this, most of this, is for the regional cooperation debt. $650 million. As you recall, some years ago, we committed to $3.5 billion for our regional cooperation debt, and that's going to be over a 10-year period, so this is part of that. I guess that's all I had on Energy Northwest. I also attended a NorNet board meeting. And the hot item there, well, it was, I won't say it was that hot, but there's just a couple of members that are interested in disbursements to members of NOAANet. And so what they committed to do was to look at that, get their lawyers involved, their accountants. You know, it's going to be minuscule. So, you know, you got to wonder if it wouldn't be better just to plow the money back into building out the NOAANet system. But anyway, that'll come up as we go forward. I'm sure they'll come to us. So that's all I had.
Will, I had a question. You were talking about a potential 200 megawatts of extra generation out of whoops. And I was wondering, will you have to upgrade your transmission?
We don't say whoops, Rick. Come on.
Will you have to upgrade your transmission?
So far, it hasn't got to that point yet. We're working with EPA and with you know, all the stakeholders on this. It's got a pretty hefty price tag, but it looks very attractive because based on resource adequacy, but it requires, you know, replacing the generator, replacing the low-pressure turbine, additional fuel in the reactor, and so on. So it's a significant amount of money.
So I would assume then that the price of the megawatts coming out of it would be very high then, on the margin.
Well, actually, it's supposed to be within Tier 1.
Oh.
So it should be, rolled into that Tier 1 price. And since you're going to pay it out over, 8 to 10 years, hopefully it won't have too big of an impact. But that's part of the analysis that's ongoing between Energy Northwest and Bonneville.
Thank you.
And I guess I should add that the agreement with Grant, we're getting down to talk. All we've got right now is a memo of understanding, and we're getting down to talking about contract language with them. And the goal is to help them provide technical support for new SMR, whether it's in Grant service area or at Site 1 next to Columbia Generating Station. But then beyond that, we would also operate that. Now, they haven't decided, but they've talked about, well, maybe we could operate it ourselves. But they don't have the skill set or so there would still be a lot of Energy Northwest support for that. And you got to think about that. This is they're recipients of this Department of Energy Advanced Reactor money, $2 billion, and that's part of their partnership with Energy Northwest. But that requires that you have a first of a kind SMR starting up in 2027. And that's pretty optimistic, so I'm not too sure that's going to happen, but we'll see.
Will, let me clarify what you said about the cost of it. You said it's going to be paid for within the tier one cost of 36 a megawatt hour, but the current cost of generation at Columbia is 42. So is it going to, that 8-year payback period, is that going to be like roughly 42 or something more?
Well, the cost of power at Columbia is melded into tier one, so it's not a separate line item.
Well, I know,
but the thing about it is, this is all in, we're doing analysis right now, we're talking to Bonneville, so it's not to the point where we can actually put a number on it. We'll move on to staff reports. The first one is update on CQ polling. Open office days. Shanda, are you online? I see you there.
Yes, I'm here.
We'll go for it.
Yeah. So since the last meeting, what we did is Nicole placed the information on our website for customers to give them a route to contact us if they had any input or concerns about the projected new schedule of that office. And I also sent right around 2,000 phone calls to Clallam Bay, CQ, Nia Bay, and the very far west Highway 112 residents with the information and how to contact us with any input. And we have not received any correspondence from any of the residents in the area with any other suggestions or concerns. With all those phone calls, I sent them out at about 50 calls per round, about every 20 minutes, so as not to overwhelm the customer service reps if they started calling back in. And I was happy with the results of that because every 50 calls that I sent, anywhere between 1 and 5 people called back that either did not listen to the message or just was curious why we called, didn't check the message. And all of those customers, we just read to them what the call had been, the information, and they all were just completely okay with having the office open on Fridays and appreciated the information. So the calls giving them the opportunity to give input worked also to notify them of the upcoming change. So it was helpful to have it worded that way. And then from here, we will work on signage and the preparations of the office to begin rotating the Forks staff there on Fridays. So far, everybody seems fine.
Great. Well, good job. I'm glad you did that poll. It's always good to get the input. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks for doing that.
Yeah, it was interesting too because several of those people use that area as a kind of a fishing season accommodations, and so we were able to pass on to them updates on the road conditions, which is obviously not us, but it was, you know, dual purpose for their phone call too.
And you could tell them whether the fish were biting or not, I guess.
Yeah, that's another month out. So.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
Yep.
Our next item is an update on district broadband grant application. Sean, are you on? I don't see it. Yeah, there he is.
Yes, sir.
So go ahead.
Yes, I understand there was a question as to awarded throughout the county. If Teresa could pull up, I've got four slides, just some pictures.
Yep, hold on.
And while
just
she's
a moment,
doing that.
Sean.
Excellent, thank you.
Get it back
so while she's bringing that up, the county was awarded $4.5 million for fiber to the home from the Washington State Public Works last fall, and that is in conjunction with the NTIA. That is a grant that they worked on, a consulting company called Petrichor, and the Port of Port Angeles and the City of Port Angeles and the City of Sequim, along with the county. That is a grant that is very specific to building out two homes directly through a third party in the Joyce area all the way to the Elwha River. The second grant that they were awarded, which I think everybody is also aware of, is the $20.2 million grant that came from the Washington State Broadband Office and also under the Department of Commerce. And that is a federally funded state awarded grants, also allowing the county to disperse funds to a third party to build out two homes between the Joyce area and the Elwha River area. Other than that, we have applied for some grants. We've been turned down. We've applied with the Washington State Public Works, Washington State Broadband Office, NTIA, USDA Rural Reconnect Program, as well as with the ARPA funds that the county was handing out, but have not been awarded any of those.
Yeah, excuse me, Sean. T, would you like me to bring up Sean's presentation?
I thought that it was brought up. I apologize.
Oh, there we go.
So that is.
Yeah.
This is just a map representing
the whole thing. Okay. So wow.
Yes. Thank you, Teresa.
Yeah. No problem.
This was awarded by the Washington State Broadband Office throughout the state. The light blue are awarded, and you can see both Jefferson and Clallam. Each received significant grant awards. Can you go to the next slide, Teresa?
No, but John will.
Yeah, let me see if I can. Okay.
This next slide is just simply showing. So this is a geometric map showing the specific areas that they're allowed to build in and that they propose to build in. Within that yellowish green area are all the areas that is mostly all aerial that they were awarded these $24 million funds to attempt to build to each home within that area.
So have we looked at the east end of the county? I mean, there's some unserved areas there as well. And I'm not saying that just because I'm close either.
Unfortunately, the way NTIA and the Washington State Broadband Office, the Public Works Office, look at our county, the east end is fully saturated.
Okay.
Anyway, there's some more information, but that pretty much covered what I mentioned. The only thing that's not in the slides, there are some grants that I am going to continue to apply for. There is a Washington State Broadband Infrastructure Acceleration Grant. That is a state grant. The deadline for that is April 1st. That is a middle mile grant that I can apply for. And then there is one other one from the NTIA that is a direct federal grant, not state awarded, that is due September 1st in 2022, and it's aptly titled Middle Mile Infrastructure Grant. So those are the two that I have earmarked for the future to apply for.
Great.
Any questions?
No, thank you very much. Good job. I do have one question. That last go round.
No, too late. That was too late. No.
It's too late? Okay. Well, I won't ask. No.
Yes. Yes,
that,
sir.
That last go round of grants that they were handed out, we didn't get anything out of that. And then Grant PUD, which is a big generator and got a lot of money and it built out a lot of broadband, they got a pretty good hefty thing. What's the logic of that? And if you don't know, just say so. I think I know what the logic is, but.
The Washington State Broadband Office did not give Grant County a grant.
Not this time, but the last time they did.
Oh, last time. I do know. They applied a lot of that based on speeds. They said that that was their first areas that they built to. And so this was a rebuild of certain areas that they already had connectivity to.
Okay.
And somehow we're able to convince people that it needs to be redone.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
Certainly.
Okay. Thanks. Okay. Board action items. T, did we capture any?
Yes, we did, Will. I have four. The first one is that staff is to look into the messaging on customer late bills to determine if it needs to be clarified. Second item is staff is to communicate to WAPED that our PUD favors fixing critical firm power for the duration of the upcoming BPA process. The third item is staff is to communicate to WAPED that our PUD favors option 2 or option 4 as presented in today's future power supply options in CETA PowerPoint. And the last item is that staff is to continue following our principle to seek lowest future cost supply options and technologies while conforming to CETA carbon requirements. That's all I have.
Okay. Well, thank you. All right, we're to our second comments from the public. T, do we have some out there?
If anyone would like to comment, please raise your hand or state your name. And I am not hearing or seeing any.
Okay, good. All right, we're going to recess from our normal meeting and go into an executive session for the purpose of discussing the potential acquisition of real estate. And it should last, what do you think, Sean?
About 30 minutes with no action.
Okay, 30 minutes, so there will be no action after we come out of executive session.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and pause for you.
It's at the UTC.
All right, we're back, you guys. I put us all in.
Okay, good.
Now, Puget also pays a 10% dividend.
Oh, really?
They got to maintain that.
Where do they buy the? Where do you buy their stock? Oh, I'll look at that one. Okay, well, we're back into normal session. We have no more business items, no more items on our agenda, so. If there's nothing else to come before the commission, we will be adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.